Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're talking about my beloved city. We're talking about Dublin. And I can already hear all the Cork people turning off and getting annoyed with me. But hang on, folks. This is a wider conversation about the urban spaces in our cities in Ireland. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and a man who hasn't lived in the city for many a year. Martin, how are you keeping?
Oh, you see, it just those blows. I'm a dope, Tony, through and through a dope.
Where were you brought up, Martin?
In North County Dublin.
There you go. I'm sorry. Fields around you. If you had land, I'm sorry, you don't qualify, right?
Oh, we had land. The back garden, Tony.
You didn't? Yeah. For listeners' benefit, Martin's back garden, you used to step over the little wall and you'd be on the third fairway on Port Marnock, so don't mind them at all.
Two walls, Tony.
Yeah. Anyway. Enough digging them. It's a bit too easy. We are delighted to be joined by Jack Sheehan, who is a writer, and I'm gonna say, because a PhD candidate in folk music, folk history in Trinity, because it's something that we might come to towards the end of the podcast. But Jack, first of all, thanks so much for joining us on the pod.
Thanks for having me.
No, it's obviously the genesis of this was your article in the Tribune about how rentier capitalism is destroying Dublin, and I did say we will talk about that predominantly, but I don't know if you're aware or if you've seen, it's been going in my head since I read your article, that Emmett Kirwan did a piece last May, actually, yeah, May 2020, called Temple Bar July 2019, and I don't know if have you seen it, Jack? No?
Yeah, I'd be familiar with it. I always think of because I saw his film. Oh my god,
Dublin Old School.
Dublin Old School. Yeah, but I'd be familiar with his work. I in some ways, it'd be written in a similar kind of register. Yeah. I mean, I was trying not to make it too much of a overly emotional piece, but I think it's I'm not a city planner or an economist or anything. It is written very much from like a personal perspective.
Yeah, no, it just is. But there's if you're familiar with the Temple Bar July 19 poem, there's a line that obviously is his refrain. He goes back to it, and it's Dublin, you're not dead yet. And I often think of that now, going, you know, that was July 2019. Jack's just written the piece now that kind of says, Dublin, you kind of are dead in a way. Can you just give us the genesis of the piece for our listeners' benefits? And obviously, we link to it in the podcast, and they can read it. I'm sure hundreds of them, thousands of them already have. It went pretty viral for you.
Yeah, I mean, the origins of it are kind of funny, actually. I was reminded of it by my cousin there yesterday. Years ago, I was watching a film in London about London, about kind of gentrification in London, and specifically about the ways in which council housing in London is kind of sold off and privatized and made into, you know, an asset rather than a home. And I wrote down kind of front and back two bits of paper and then stuck them in a cupboard for a while. And I wrote different versions of it kind of down the years. Like an initial version of it was written about Apollo House, which kind of turns up in the piece, but it's not what it's about. I've kind of added to it a bit and taken away from it a bit over the last few years. But the real impetus for finishing it and for pitching it was the fact that I think a lot of the issues that are latent or have been latent in Dublin and in cities around the world over the last few years have come to a head because of the COVID restrictions. So everything like, you know, the fact that there are no toilets, the privatization of public space, the privatization of housing, the fact that people are crammed in together is sort of ignorable as long as, you know, all of the other creature comforts of living in a city exist. But the second that they get taken away and everyone gets forced to inhabit that privatized public space, it brings it to a head, and you see the results of it, as you know, we've seen over the last few weeks or months. So while I, you know, kind of wanted to add in stuff that was more up to date, I kind of decided against it because it is just about what the underlying conditions of it are rather than the effects.
Which was really good, because as people, like, we've been doing this for a while now, even when before we were podcasting, we were blogging and giving out. But at least you had the piece goes back to the genesis of inviting in the foreign capital, you know, and I don't know if you if you're aware, but I got slated by Pascal Donoghue in the finance committee because I was quoted to him for saying that, you know, Michael Noonan sent out the invitations, Simon Coveney set the table, Owen Murphy delivered the drinks, and now Dara O'Brien is asking if anybody wants any aperitifs. And Pascal was very upset about it. But you did outline the genesis of how that private capital that the city is awash with has been what has been the main source of the really what I would term the destruction of the public sphere.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you know, I would even go further back than that. Like, the calculation in this country since at least the 1960s has been basically, you know, we cannot be trusted or don't have the resources to do anything ourselves. And the only way in which we can kind of get anything done or get any amount of capital into the country is to make ourselves so open to international capital and so available to international capital that will have to come. And it's based on the calculation that Ireland is such a small country that the massive flows of international capital will have a disproportionate effect. So, you know, the positive side of this that people see is like foreign direct investment and factories opening. And if one factory opens in Cork versus America, it means much more to Cork than it does to America. But that calculation is so hard-coded into the Irish political psyche that when, you know, the property market shit the bed and, you know, there was nowhere to go but kind of cap in hand to the world, the decision was made that you had to make, in order to reinflate the property prices and the market, you had to make Ireland essentially the Wild West of property investment, that there are no rules. You can do anything you want. You can buy up as much as you want and you can do anything with it. And I think like part of it is, you know, the piece is about public space and it's about the effects on housing and everything like that. But it's also, you know, something that I think we need to reckon with in this country, which is that the model of allowing international capital to determine what happens in this country, it has to end. Like, we have to find some other way of running our economy and politics.
I think that the proof positive of that, Jack, is that the generation, or we'll say those under 35, under 40 at the moment, they're going to be worse off than their parents. So the model isn't working. It simply isn't working for a large percentage of the population. So it begs the question, why are we doing it at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge, like, obviously there are ideological reasons behind it. Like, a party like Fine Gael, they consider themselves to be kind of the custodians of that ideology, of that, like, you know, I guess, globalized financial capital having a place in Ireland. They consider themselves to be that, to be sacrosanct, and them to be the custodians of it.
Well, like, just on that point, and I'll let you finish, but just be clear, the Taoiseach wrote a piece in the Irish Times recently in praise of CETA, the Canadian the free trade agreement. And I'm doing air quotes around free trade, but he almost referred to it as Ireland's natural resources. And he said that they're his words. So, you know, we've no oil or gas or diamonds, he said, but we have this access to this market and foreign capital. Sorry, Jack, go ahead.
No, it's like you're absolutely right. And like, the frustrating thing I think about a lot of this is that, as with any bad ideology, there is a very small amount of truth that undergirds it. And like, Ireland does not have the natural resources that other countries do. It doesn't have the scale that other countries do. And it's also, which I think is kind of conveniently forgotten a lot of the time, it's a post-colonial country in a lot of ways. Like, it's a country whose industrial capacity was deliberately suppressed by Britain in order to keep it as a raw materials exporter. And you know, the frustrating thing when you have arguments with people like Pascal Donoghue, not that I'm having arguments with Pascal Donoghue, but is that, like, there is that grain of truth to it. They say, we don't have diamonds, we don't have oil. You know, I think that where the problem is that the solution to that does not have to be the same solution that it has been in the last 50 years, which is just to kind of totally surrender to whatever the whims of international capital are.
But I think, too, that there is always the get-out clause, and it's the same get-out clause that every government has had from year dot. And that's that young people will leave the country when it's bad enough to leave. And I think, although it's not overtly spoken about, I certainly believe that it's the plan in the back pocket for any government in Ireland. If things get too bad, let's just ship them out somewhere else. And that's every generation. Maybe the Celtic Tiger generation missed a little bit of it, but that's been going on from year dot.
Yeah, and it's the perfect solution if you're a right wing party, because the most in a large degree, the people who feel they have the least prospects in this country, who would be the people who are most likely to vote against you in an election, are the ones who leave. And should they come back, they'll probably come back with enough capital extracted from somewhere else to buy a house. And if they buy a house, well, that's one reason why they were voting against you that's removed. Maybe you can just quietly,
and we have them
back into the fold.
And then we have the myth of, sure, I got on to get on, so why should I, that moral hazard question that we're really terrible at in this country. And it's one of those disgraceful things where there was no question of moral hazard when it came to banks. There's no question of moral hazard when it comes to corporations. But when it came to the idea, and it's really coming now, Jack, you're going to see it more than ever, the idea, because there will be a referendum on the right to housing to balance the rights of private property. It will be, the government will allow this referendum to take place. Whatever the phrasing of it's going to be very critical, but they already hear the noises of no free houses, no free houses. And that is going to pit the divisive rhetoric of, and I have to say, of me and Martin's generation against yours.
Yeah, and like that's the thing that, I always think the one of the most revelatory comments that came out in the last couple of months was Dara O'Brien, our wonderful house minister, was being interviewed, and he mentioned that he had bought a house basically at the worst possible time, like 2005 or 6, and had ended up in negative equity, shock horror, the worst thing anyone can end up in. And he said some comment like, it happened to all of my friends and I'm never going to let something like that happen again. And it is a very fundamental idea, is that, when that point came where it became apparent that all these houses were overvalued and they had been bought overvalued, there was a point at which you could have said, okay, what we need here is kind of debt consolidation, some sort of financial instrument that maybe gets people out of this massive debt if they're trying to get out of it, or, just accepts that basically, this is your family home, you're not going to be moving, maybe you took a bit of a bath on it, but, that's the hazard of investing in any kind of, asset. But instead, that was seen as kind of completely beyond the pale, because the exact people who were voting for Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael were the exact people who were underwater. And so the decision was made to reinflate those prices. And now we're again in a situation where they're clearly overinflated. But no one can turn around and say house prices don't need to stop growing. They need to be cut by 50%, because that would mean, oh no, the thing I invested all of my money and time in, turns out it was just a bubble.
Yeah, I you've just summed it up perfectly. And there's I don't know if you're familiar with Professor Emeritus at Trinity in Economics, PJ Drudy. But PJ was our first guest at our very first ever live show. And he's an older gentleman who said that basically it doesn't matter to him whether his house is worth £1 million or 250,000. He'd like to see his grandchildren. He has a good handle on that. But unfortunately, many feel that this is how we've based our sort of, once the phrase property ladder became ubiquitous, we lost the run of ourselves in terms of that. And we also then we've made it worse, because now we haven't just got, a landlord of a mom and pop landlord, as they were commonly referred to. Now we have big, giant conglomerates who are, like, if you measure them, they are bigger than the global the global economy of men in many scales. Like, the housing trading dwarfs the if you put the top seven economies together, the trading in property is three times bigger, according to the UN's special rapporteur for housing. So it's big business, and we've invited them in. And we you started this by saying that we need a change in a huge change in direction, but do you see anything that gives people of your generation any sort of hope that there are going to be those changes? Anybody brave enough to do it?
Well, like Okay, I start off this answer by saying I'm not a party political member. I'm not a member of any political party and never have been, mostly out of, laziness. But, I voted for Richard Boyd Barrett in the last two elections. I think he's a really good guy. I'm a Dublin Bay South resident now, and I'm going to vote for Lynn Boylan. I think she's really good. But honestly, if you were to look at people my age who don't own a house, I think an awful lot of them would look towards Sinn Féin, myself included, to a great degree, not because they think Sinn Féin are perfect, but because they see in the Sinn Féin front bench, and particularly Ona Brin, people who are willing to take concrete steps to make housing speculation and, you know, what's referred to as rent share capital, basically the extraction of rents, unprofitable. And if that's unprofitable, those houses don't disappear. They have to go somewhere. And so they may come back onto the market. In a broader sense, they look like people who are going to heavily reinvest in public housing for a much wider variety of people. And if you look at those two things, it's no mystery as to why, Sinn Féin are fairly dominant among people of my age.
I think, Mark, can I make one? We haven't spoken on the podcast in ages about rent seeking and rent seeking as a form of the form of rentier capitalism that Jack just referred to, because it's important that we used to talk about it a lot, Martin, when we started, about the fact that we had a rent seeking property market. And essentially, and Lorcan Sir put it brilliantly way back in probably episode 32 of this podcast, and we're now at 570, where he said the market's doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's extracting the maximum amount of profit from the minimum amount of services, and so rent seeking is by definition, they say it's extracting more wealth but without increasing this overall size of the pie, and that's it in a layman's term, nice and simple. But what you're referring to there is ultimately, we saw today, Martin, in the Dublin Inquirer covering what's happening with O'Devney Gardens. Where the density in O'Devney Gardens, which people were warned about, you're going to vote for this and they're going to submit at that, but then they're going to change the plans and put in more units. And now we're seeing densities that are the equivalent of Tokyo.
Yeah, Hong Kong. And prices have gone up since 2012 by 99% on housing. And the average age of your first-time single buyer is now 42. So, I mean, if you're under 42... and your wages haven't gone up by 99% since 2012. Well, you're not at the game. You don't have a chance. What you really should be buying is a ticket out of the country, to somewhere which will give you a chance. How do you rectify it, Jack?
Two things. I mean, one, I don't want to always center things in terms of party politics, because like, one of the most heartening things for me over the last few years, and I mentioned it in the piece, is the establishment of CATU, the Community Action Tenants Union. And I think there's a crucial distinction to be made between them and previous waves of housing activism, even though they involve many of the same people, obviously. I think they're correctly structuring themselves as a series of kind of localized unions that feed into a national... a national kind of framework. And I think the structure of a dues paying union is also the right one. I actually don't know if they pay dues, so don't quote me on that. But, you know, you give people investment in a localized advocacy and resistance group, which has national goals, but can act, you know, locally in terms of stopping evictions, in terms of helping people out with bad landlords. I mean, I know two friends of mine at least, who have been directly helped by CATU in getting deposits back and getting landlords to respond on things. And the thing is, if you could build an effective form of dual powers, and if you could get a government in there, which was at the very least not hostile to tenants, was building public housing and was increasing, you know, regulation on international capital, and was doing X, Y, and Z, was doing things to make rent seeking unprofitable in the medium term. And at the same time, you had a robust network of kind of advocacy and resistance groups that could make it expensive and difficult to evict people and to, you know, raise rents and to do everything else. Well, you've kind of got them coming and going. And I think an awful lot of people, an awful lot of landlords, both at small and large level, would just choose to exit the market. I think the crucial thing, if I just one final point on that, is that I think you need to be ready for that exodus from the market. You used to get these letters in the Irish Times being like, oh, if, you know, if they don't stop this, there'll be no landlords left in the market. That would be great if you're me. But even if a lot of them left, you need to be ready for it. And you need to have a public sector, that can buy up those houses.
I have to convert them. I have to commit on that, because it goes right back to what Eric Lonergan said on the podcast, who we wouldn't agree on everything with. Eric is he's a hedge fund manager by trade. So, but his point was very simple. If the state was to step in and buy those now, and effectively they can borrow cheaper than anybody in the world, like any private individual, then they can pay for them over 25 years and own the asset, as opposed to now currently renting them from these vulture funds. So we would then increase our, back to the days when we used to say we have a social housing stock, and we'd increase our stock overnight by stepping into those things. And we do it relatively cost neutral. And not only that, it wouldn't hurt Ireland on the debt to GDP ratio, because as we spend the money, we'd be acquiring assets. So we're not really screwing ourselves in terms of the EU's fiscal rules, which many of our fiscal hawks in terms of the Department of Finance worry themselves about. And I think you make a crucial point around Catu. I think it's really important that people do check out the work they do. It is fantastic. You're talking to someone who was in North Frederick Street, we recorded the podcast within the building at one stage. And I've seen the action that these people, the people involved, are really, really determined and really know their stuff. So it's great that that's happening. But as you're doing that, you also need the state to be moving. And the one thing I'd kick back on, and again, Dara O'Brien, you generally listen to these podcasts. Do you remember the morning after you took action to stop the funds? Their share value went up, Dara. It didn't bother them in the slightest. That would be my biggest concern. So without political action, we need it on both sides. Sorry, go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, I also think that, if we look back historically, this is the same battle that's been fought in Ireland for hundreds and hundreds of years, hundreds of years. And in hundreds of years, we've never come up with a solution that works for people. Never, ever. I would have thought that we've evolved enough to do something. Do you think there's any hope, Jack?
I would say, while this has been going on for a long time, I do feel quite hopeful at this time, because you have a kind of a unique set of material circumstances, in that like you just have a large amount of the population which is young and does not have assets and does not have, don't own homes. But I also think there's a greater degree of kind of solidarity and convergence between different struggles. So I think in the past you might have seen the left to some degree, at least, this is maybe a stereotype, but not engaging as much with, more rural concerns around eviction, or you see things like the MICA redress stuff in Donegal. And I think now you have a left which is engaging at a much greater degree, and which sees the connections between those things and sees them fundamentally as part of the same fight. But I mean, I don't know, I found... Actually, Owen O'Brien's book, Home, I found a really, really good corrective to kind of despair on the issue, because there's quite a dry history in the first 100 pages of basically housing in the state. But he just lays out all of the different failures and why they happened and who they were trying to serve and where we are now and what you could do. And I found it kind of the opposite of a despairing book. It's just a very much a, here is why the housing market is dysfunctional. It has been dysfunctional for a very, very long time. And here's what you could do to fix it, And like, I don't know, there are lots of things that give me hope. I actually am, despite how despairing the piece seemed, I think to a lot of people, I'd be more hopeful now than I would have been 5-10 years ago.
I'm not sure if people were despairing or they just sort of mourned a loss. I think there's more mourning a loss that we've lost a city. We've lost a city that was ours, and it's just not anymore.
I'm gonna just say we're all nostalgic for the city that we knew, Martin. That's always going to evolve. Like,
no,
I remember,
it wasn't the best city. It certainly wasn't the best city. But
well, it was when I was growing up because it was my era, right? But,
Jack is living there in Rathmines. I mean, I was able to go and rent a place in Rathmines. It was only tiny, but 35 quid a week, which was somewhere around 15% of income at the time. And it gave me great freedom as a young person. And I think young people have been denied that chance to grow up and that freedom that I had.
Well, I think that's the big thing. It's the combination. It's like the way, you know, in the 70s, they had stagflation, you know, that had never happened before, unemployment and inflation at the same time. And I think it's the crucial thing of, like, when I was in college, it was like 2009 to 2015. I kind of took the scenic route, but it was obviously very bleak. Like, that's the peak years, all of the peak years of the recession. But it was also grand, because as a student you have a very fixed amount of money. It's not very much, but it's very fixed, and rent was very, very cheap, and pints were cheap, everything was cheap, and so you could enjoy yourself. And I think what there is at the moment is crucially that combination of not having a lot of money and everything being very expensive, which, as you say, like, is it not only does it delay your kind of ability to buy a house or do whatever else, but it also makes you not enjoy the time that you're not doing it.
Well, when you think about that in context of, everybody was told, you know, take away pints, standing on the street is bad, sitting at a book table, spending, you know, this money, that's good. And it very much is, you know, people, again, in my own economic demographic are going, yeah, why can't they just all sit and pay $7.50 a pint? Like, you know, and it very much is that, or, you know, have an outdoor summer. And of course, you should be able to go out to, like, the sun is coming in my window here, Jack, as you can see. I should be able to go out to my garden and enjoy it, you know. But yeah, there is very much a difference. But I do feel, when you look at the most recent opinion polls, that there's a shift in some of that mindset. Not all. A lot of ABC ones will continue to vote with their wallets, and that's just what they're going to do. But many of them are looking around and saying, like Professor PJ Drudy, I would like to see my grandkids, as opposed to that. Sorry, Martin.
Yeah. There's more to life than work, sleep, pay rent, repeat. I think there's much more to life. Jack, where can people read your pieces?
Anything that I publish outside, you can find on Twitter at Yulegoat, Yulegoat. That's a long story. But I write a Substack, which is like a kind of a monthly newsletter. I write about music, history, and politics, that kind of thing. And that's just jacksheehan.substack.com. It's called The Rising of the Moon. But yeah, you can find me at Yulegoat on Twitter. That's where most of my stuff happens, though I try to stay off of it as much as possible.
Yeah, because we're all addicted at this stage, mate. Yeah.
Jack, thank you so much for having this chat with us. I do hope that the city improves, and I know Tony hopes so too, where we do a little bit more than hope. We agitate and we push and we annoy people. So hopefully some of that makes a difference. And hopefully we'll have you back on in a while, and you'll be tell us how Dublin transformed into the most livable city in the world.
I hope so. And thank you very much for having me.
Two sentences to finish. The first is, I'm dying to talk to you another time about the whole folk music history linked with politics and the art of a good protest song and that. And then the second, going back to where I began, Emmett Kirwan's poem and his refrain, Dublin, you're not dead yet. Talk to you all soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.